It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Veronica Rickert. Coming up later in the program, a look at a lawsuit filed today challenging Wisconsin's ban on same-sex marriage.
First, it's part two of a series produced by WPR and the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism on releasing and retaining violent sex offenders in Wisconsin's criminal justice system. Today, it's a look at the Sand Ridge Secure Treatment Center in Mauston, which looks and feels like a prison, but the sex offenders held there are considered patients, not inmates. Gilman Halstead reports on the treatment these patients receive as they try to shed the label the state has given them of being sexually violent people.
Visitors to Sand Ridge go through a metal detector and then a gate in a razor wire fence and several secure doors before entering the antiseptically clean and brightly lit hallways. The cream-colored cinder block walls are decorated with a blue trim. Hallways are brighter than those at a typical maximum security prison in the state. Some patients working in the cafeteria or doing janitorial jobs wear green smock-like shirts, but those who have made the most progress in their treatment can wear their own clothes. Making progress in therapy is easier for some than it is for others. Clint is 49 years old and has been at Sand Ridge since 2008 after serving a 17-year sentence in prison for sexual assault and homicide. He says the treatment is helping him prepare for supervised release.
As far as the law goes, we're here for treatment. As far as supervised release goes, that's what I'm planning to do. I have to have significant progress in treatment. So it's helpful that way.
He says much of the 6 hours of treatment he takes part in each week are a rehash of programs he completed while in prison. Some involve role plays where he has to confront his risk factors for reoffending. The most useful one, he says, is simply called mindfulness.
I find that really helpful. Learning how to slow my thinking down, learning how to process things that I'm going through in order to make better decisions.
Clint is among the 82% of patients who've been diagnosed with a personality disorder specifically related to sex offending. Another 10% have a serious mental illness, such as schizophrenia, and 9% are labeled mentally retarded. Sand Ridge Research Director David Thornton says there's also a minority of patients who simply refuse treatment.
You'll have some individuals who've essentially made the life choice that committing sex offenses and thinking about committing future sex offenses is a life that they enjoy better than what would be involved in the hard work of changing themselves and living in a law-abiding way in the community.
Even the patients who don't cooperate with the therapy requirements have the same right to petition a court for release as those who do undergo treatment, but their likelihood of success is slim. One patient interviewed for this story did win a court battle for release without going through treatment. Thomas served 17 years in prison for sexual assault before being committed to Sand Ridge in 2004. During an interview before his release, he voiced a concern many patients at Sand Ridge share. He says if a mental illness diagnosis is the trigger for commitment to the center, then men like him should have the option of getting outpatient treatment instead of being locked up.
Why not go to the mental health facility in your community? Like Green Bay, they have Brown County Mental Health Facility. Why not then go in there? They have sex treatment there also. So to just put you here and not put you in your community's one, because your community's paying the bill, and not let you go there, why not?
Other Sand Ridge patients challenged the right of the state to keep them locked up at all for crimes they might commit after they've already served time for a crime they did commit. Gilman Halstead, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Tomorrow in part three of that series, we'll look at the case of a Sand Ridge patient who doesn't think he belongs there at all because he says he's not mentally ill. Meanwhile, you can see the full report at wisconsinwatch.org and in newspapers around the state. Nearly 100 million people tuned into Fox last night to watch Super Bowl 48. Some were Denver fans, some were Seattle fans, some just wanted to see all the big commercials, which become almost bigger than the game itself for some people.
The ads this year were either home runs or spectacular flops, depending on who you ask. But from a marketing perspective, which ones really worked?
Here to break down this year's batch of ads is Derek Rucker. He's professor of marketing in the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University, where he co-leads the Super Bowl Advertising Review. Derek, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's start with a broad question here. What's the goal of these hyper-expensive Super Bowl ads? What are they hoping to get out of that?
Yeah, one of the goals is it's an immense reach strategy in terms of just hitting a lot of consumers all at once, right? So you're going to have like 100 million people looking at this ad. So if I have a new product launching, a new message, a new positioning, this is a way for me to get a massive footprint in front of a lot of people.
Used to be it was a tightly guarded secret. They surprised you with their big ad. Now it seems like, I saw a bunch of ads for the Bud Light ad in the last like 3 weeks of football games. People are leaking, showing snippets here and there. Why that change?
Well, there's a few reasons. So one is that as costs have gone up, brands are forced to figure out how do they maximize the spend, right? So now it's not just about the 30 seconds. Having 100 million people see it, that's still important, but I'm trying to maximize consumer engagement both before the spot airs and after it. So we're trying to get the most for our money in our buys. That means taking advantage of it at more than a single point in time.
Before we start digging into the particular ads, just some general impressions. Is it just me, or is there a lot less sex out front and center in these ads than there used to be?
Yeah, I would say that this was a really subdued year for the Super Bowl advertising. So one of the kind of golden metric for me is there an ad from the bunch that's going to be in my Hall of Fame of Super Bowl ads? And it happens in recent years. So I think of Volkswagen's Darth Vader ad, right? The little kid walking. And people know this ad. They love it for a few years back. I don't think there's a single ad here that's going to make it to that degree where 2 years from now we're talking about it.
Well, it seems like the theme of the successful ads here were things that make us go, aw. So family, inspiration.
Emotional stirring, yeah.
Let's check out a Cheerios ad along that line. I think it might be a good example. Here it is.
Pretty soon, you're going to have a baby brother.
And a puppy.
Deal.
Okay, just and these we've seen this family, I think, in Cheerios ads in the past, just like a slice of life family scene.
Yeah, I think it's one of those. It's just wholesome. It's with the brand's equity. It's a spot where I think if you'd had those over the top ads that may not have done as well, but given that the overall competition wasn't that fierce in the ad world, it worked this year.
Let's check out. You mentioned a past one from Volkswagen. Let's listen to a piece of what they did this time around.
Absolutely.
Hey, Darcy, look. 100,000 miles.
So?
It's a big deal. What if I told you that every time a Volkswagen hits 100,000 miles, a German engineer gets his wings?
And we see the German engineer getting his wings. That was
many
another
of them.
One. Many of them, right. That was another one that you rated highly. Why?
So that one is, I think, what it does what a good ad should do, which is it's entertaining and engaging, right? So the whole idea of getting their wings, that's cute. People can relate to that. But at the same time, that story tells you something about the brand, which is our reliability, right? Or a brand, it's happening. So it's not just that one engineer gets the wings. It's that many are getting them, and it's happening a lot. So it's both a clever message to draw the audience in, and it actually says something about the brand, and that's what we care about.
Well, and that's the thing that I would imagine advertisers worry about, but seems to happen every year. You've come up with a brilliant, clever, funny, heartwarming, whatever ad, and then people talk about the ad but don't remember the brand.
It's exactly the problem. It's this constant tension between strategy and creative, and the brands that work best are ones that have figured it out. They figured out, we have a game plan. We know what the consumer needs to hear. Figure out how to say it in a really clever way. And the great thing about Super Bowl advertising is every year there are brands that fail.
We'll talk about some more of those Super Bowl ads. We're talking about the crop of Super Bowl ads, less sex, less zaniness, more heartwarming for the most part. We've got Derek Rucker with the Super Bowl Advertising Review with us now. We'd like to hear from you, too. What was your favorite or your least favorite spot from last night, or maybe your favorite Super Bowl ad of all time. Give a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send an email, talk@WPR.org. We're talking about the best and worst of the year's Super Bowl commercials, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What ads worked for you? Are you running out to the store now to buy some Bud Light or Coca-Cola or a Maserati? Pick me one up while you're out. You can call in at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. We've got Denise in Milwaukee on the line. Denise, hi.
Hi there. I wanted to just mention the Coca-Cola ad because it's getting so much flack on Facebook. It's really nasty comments about it. And we really felt it was a wonderful, diverse, true representation of population in the United States. And, you know, there was something like, for example, one of the languages I believe was Hawaiian. And there was a lot of statements around how that, you know, none of that's English, that's American. You know? But, you know, Hawaii is a state. And if they're speaking Hawaiian there, then guess what? That's American, too.
Denise, thanks for bringing that one up. We've got a clip from the song. It's a version of America the Beautiful in a Coke ad.
Beautiful for spacious skies.
Por tus olas de granos tambar.
Your peach in the tzakuti.
So what do you think of that one? What is this an effective brand strategy?
You know, for a panel, that ad did fine. I think it fits with what Coca-Cola typically does, which is to kind of focus on warm and happy moments. So I think as a brand, you know, it fell in the middle of the pack, I think, between a B and a C. To the comment that was raised by Denise, I believe, I think that's a great example of how social media is transforming how people communicate. So there were some people who talked negatively about it, but if you look at it, there were then people who were outraged at the outragers.
Right. So, Derek, that's Coke maybe sent a message, maybe knowing that they were trolling a bit, they're going to get a bit of a response that reinforces what they were doing in the first place.
It's possible. I don't know if that was intentional. We usually try not to do that in advertising and get negative elements. But I think what it says is that, look, any consumer can have their opinion of an ad, and that's kind of what makes it interesting. When people go negative, social media allows that to spread faster. But now we actually have people who are willing to jump in and police there. And so you see people coming to the brand's defense, like for the example it was given by the caller. You know, it's like, well, they're singing in Hawaiian.
Well, and Coke, you know, they did I'd Like to Teach the World to Sing years ago. This
Absolutely.
One is another happy, touchy-feely thing. Does it tell us anything about Coke, though?
Well, so what you have to
Fizzy.
It's a great question. And what you have to realize is as brands mature or get more advanced, the consumer knows enough about the core brand that I don't need to convince you, drink Coke, here's how it tastes or here's what it's like. The consumer knows that experience. So it really is about creating a more fundamental relationship with the consumer between the brand. So that's why you see these emotional appeals being represented, because it's just about you enjoying the brand, thinking positively about the brand.
Talking to Derek Rucker of Northwestern University about Super Bowl ads. Join in with your favorites or least favorites. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's check out another ad. This one, I think this is another one of your highly rated ones. This is Microsoft.
Mm-hmm.
Technology has taken us places we've only dreamed.
Now I can do whatever I want.
It gives hope to the hopeless.
Can you hear me talking?
Okay, so this was a tearjerker one. The visuals you're not seeing along with it are a kid who's a double amputee walking on high-tech legs, and somebody deployed overseas witnessing the birth of his daughter. This seemed like Microsoft viewed as a stodgy company, technology viewed as a cold, heartless sort of thing, and then trying to make it as warm and human as possible in this ad, Derek.
Yeah, I think, and this one did really well with our panel. It was actually the top rated. And I think the reason it resonated with them is that you see the brand strategy and the emotionally compelling message, which is you think about Apple, who has positioned themselves well as cool and hip. And now Microsoft is kind of coming back and saying, well, we're important too. And we're important in the sense of technology doing meaningful things in people's lives.
All right. We've got callers coming in. We've got a tweet first from Allison, who writes, "Everyone is still talking about that brilliant e-surance commercial. It was promoted on Twitter beforehand. I've been getting updates all day on how many of my friends have followed the @esurancemillion handle. Smart way to spend a lot of money, but engage your fans." Is that the one at the end of the game with John Krasinski, I think, from The Office with a big pile of money, or am I mixing that up?
I think that's right. I think that's the, you know, rather than spend during the Super Bowl, we're going to spend, you know, $1.5 million to a lucky fan of some sort. I believe that's what it was, a $1.5 million giveaway.
Right. Right. And, you know, I was wondering, do advertisers have a heart attack when the game is a blowout as it was last night? And maybe people aren't going to stick around to watch their fourth quarter or post game ad?
You do. So the funny thing is, when we were doing the ad review, we had both Denver and Seattle fans in our panel. And so the Seattle fans were obviously ecstatic. And I remember standing up when I think it was like 29 or nothing. I'm like, "So I know you Seattle fans are really happy. Advertisers, not happy right now."
Right. Right.
So you worry about that. You know, the good news is that for the best ads or the best brands, and this is part of the reason that justifies the price tag, is that people are talking about them the next day, and they're easy to watch again on YouTube now, right? So this is where media really helps, social media and online really helps, is that if you missed it, but something was so good that you're hearing about it, you can still see it. Of course, if it's not so good, you're not going to see it at all.
Sorry to those Denver fans in your group. We'll go back to the phones now with Amanda in Watertown. Hi there, Amanda.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I find it very interesting that there's so much controversy surrounding the Coke ad when the Cheerios ad was actually a response to the multiracial controversy that happened in the first place with their first ad.
Interesting point, Amanda. Derek, that's right. There was controversy about that it's a multiracial family in that Cheerios ad.
Yeah, actually, that was something, you know, that was really neat and bold to see Cheerios go, is to say, "We're sticking with our message. You know, and we realized that times have changed, and so we're not going to go backwards and say, you know, concede that point." So that was kind of a really bold move by the brand that was beautiful to see. And I think what it shows you is that, you know, the whole idea of whether an ad is racy or it says something wrong, it's subjective. And it's which ones do you have enough of a critical mass behind to push.
Speaking of times have changed, let's check out this ad from Radio Shack.
Yeah.
Okay.
What?
The 80s called. They want their store back.
And then there's a parade of 80s icons. Alf, Hulk Hogan, Mary Lou Retton, and more.
Dee Snider.
Right, yeah. So this is one really acknowledging what is seen as a downside of a store and trying to reframe it.
Yeah, and so this was my personal favorite ad. And I think that's partly the fact that I'm a child of the 80s.
Me
so
too, yeah.
If you grew up in the 80s, it's like, oh, wow, this had a moment for you, right? And I just remember seeing, I watched it a few times and realizing all the things I missed the first time. So it's like, oh, there's Kid in Play. There's that owl from Clash of the Titans. And so all these things are flooding back. And so I think what's interesting is if you look at our panel, who are about 26, like, yeah, they missed the 80s. So that shows you for a population, and our panel still liked it, by the way. They still gave it a B because they said, hey, it shows a very clear positioning change, right? Radio Shack is trying to say we used to be this way, now we're this way. But I think it had some added zest for individuals who actually could resonate with those characters.
Back to the phones now. We've got Gina in Milwaukee. Hi there, Gina.
Hello.
What's your ad?
My favorite ad, and it's going to stay with me, is the Chobani ad with John Stamos. I mean, it's talking about generations that it appealed to. I remember John Stamos when he was Blackie, and I had his picture posted all over my wall. And then he went into the 80s with Full House, and they kind of brought his sex appeal, which he's never aged in all these years, and to tie in the Full House, it was just funny. It was a phenomenal ad, I think. And I won't forget the brand of Chobani.
All right. John Stamos gets an A for sexiness from Gina, Derek.
Yeah, it's pretty funny in her comment. Like, that was actually the Dannon's brand, not the Chobani ad.
Uh-oh. That's right. Chobani had the bear?
They had the bear ad. So that's okay, because it shows that she really did like Stamos. And that shows you a classic problem in advertising that, you know, that might be an isolated incident and not representative of all consumers. But sometimes when you use celebrity, if the celebrity overwhelms the execution, you get exactly that phenomena, which is, oh, I love the Stamos ad. Oh, it was for yogurt. And if you think of Greek yogurt, Chobani's the one that often comes to mind.
Just about out of time, Derek, I wanted to end by asking you, are Super Bowl ads worth the money?
They are for the right brand. And so what's that mean? That means a brand who's going to have a creative strategy that is going to get talked about and deliver a powerful brand message. If you have those things in place, this is just a massive audience to reach. If you don't, though, if you're just bringing like your B or your C game, it's not the place to do it.
Well, Derek, you brought your A game today. Thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
That's Derek Rucker. He co-leads the Super Bowl Advertising Review at Northwestern University. We've been talking about the best and worst ads at last night's Super Bowl. You can keep the conversation going on the Central Time Facebook page.